Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, remembering Gloria Vanderbilt, the fashion icon, artist, and mother of CNN's Anderson Cooper, died last month at age 95. Ever since she was a child, Gloria Vanderbilt lived a life very much in the public eye. A custody battle over her in 1934 was called the Trial of the Century. But as Anderson Cooper says, there was much they never talked about. After Vanderbilt turned 91, mother and son began opening up to each other about their lives and their grief. It resulted in a book titled The Rainbow Comes and Goes. In 2016, the two came onto my show to talk about their experiences. Cooper was with me in the studio in Washington and Vanderbilt from New York. I would like to know from you, Anderson, how this all started. Who had the idea?
When my mom turned 91, she sent me an email. It was a short email, but it was very clever and funny and reflective. It was about turning 91 and something that her aunt had said to her when she turned 17. And her aunt had said, imagine you're 17 whole years old today. It got me thinking about where my mom is in her life and not being 91. And when my father died when I was 10, I always imagined that he had written me a letter that would show up at some point after he had died.
That you would find.
That I would find, somewhere. That would arrive on my 18th birthday or my 21st birthday. And of course, a letter never arrived, but I didn't want there to be that sense with my mom when she's no longer here. I didn't want there to be anything left unsaid between us or a sense that there were things I didn't know about her that she didn't know about me as an adult. And I thought, starting on her 91st birthday, why don't we start a new way of talking with each other? Why don't we try to have a new kind of conversation, putting aside, you know, any of the old inhibitions or any of the old anything that exists between a parent and a child, you know, embarrassments, resentments, past anger, whatever it may be. And we've always had a good relationship, but why don't we learn about each other, you know, as adults in a different way.
But did you want to put it in the form of letters or did you actually converse?
No, we started it over email. And because I travel a lot, to do it in person just wouldn't have been possible.
Right.
And so we started this conversation over email. And it was interesting because sometimes we would send emails to each other three or four times a day. Sometimes a few days would go by, you know, without conversing. But there was something about doing it over email that kind of freed us in a way, because it was almost like putting a message in a bottle and sending it out. And then suddenly a day later or an hour later or 10 minutes later, another bottle would come back with another message. And about 3 months into doing this, I started telling my friends, you know, I'm doing this thing with my mom and it's actually really changing our relationship. I'm learning things about myself and learning things about her. And every one of my friends who I mentioned it to said, God, I wish I could have done that with my mom who's no longer here or my father, or I wish I could do that with my partner or my friend. And so I suggested to my mom after about 3 months, you know, maybe we should actually think about this as a book, because I do think this is something that a lot of people would like to change the way they converse, certainly, especially with an aging parent before it's too late.
Gloria, how did you feel about this idea initially?
Well, I thought it was there's something, you know, about writing by email, because usually when I'm writing a book, I write a sentence and then I agonize over it again and again and again and edit it and re-edit it. And when you're writing by email, you just kind of, you know, it's sort of off the cuff. And we would write to each other and it was so freeing because I would write to him and then I would, you know, press it to go. And, you know, there's that little zing when you know it's gone off and you can't change it. You can't get it back. And it was really an extraordinary kind of feeling of being able to communicate without any sort of fear of, you know, having to rephrase it or to really just say it absolutely honestly the way I was feeling it.
Gloria, the conversation between you and Anderson begins with your life. Your father died when you were an infant. You certainly were not close with your mother. Your nanny actually raised you. Had you, Anderson, not known any of this?
I knew, obviously, the
some
sort of outlines,
yeah.
But I had never really heard it from my mom. And I had never, at 91, 92, when we were writing this, you know, she has a very different perspective on her life than she had even, I think, 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago.
When she talked with me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think her perspective as a 92-year-old person now is she's got this incredible perspective on her life and an incredible ability to talk about it. When we were growing up, she never really talked about her past. She didn't really talk about – my father was very communicative. He had grew up in a poor family in the South. He had told lots of stories. My mom, because of the conflicts of her past and the difficulty of her childhood, she really just didn't go into detail about it. It was something of a mystery to me.
There was indeed a huge custody trial. And you said you were reminded of that, Gloria, when Anderson told you he was gay. Now, tell us why and how you reacted.
First of all, when he first told me, he said, "I think I'm
I remember
gay.
That. I and, think
and,
I'm
and,
gay.
Yeah, I regret.
And,
I regretted saying I think I am instantly. I certainly knew I was.
I thought, you know, I mean, we all go through different phases of sexuality and we come and change and go and so forth. So it sounded as if he wasn't sure yet. So I said, well, you know, just think about it. And then he suddenly left the room without continuing on. So it was sort of left up in the air.
What she said was, don't make any definite decisions, which was not exactly the response I had anticipated. This was when I was 21.
What did you think she was going to say?
I really wasn't sure. I mean, I'd come out to my friends in high school, and I told my mom, I think, you know, my last year of college when I was 21, and I'd grown up with gay people in our house all the time. My mom had tons of gay friends and had always said, you know, very supportive things about them. I remember her saying, there was a famous director named Jose Quintero who, you know, he and his partner, Nick, were always over at the house. And I remember I was 11 years old one time, and it must have been 1979. And I was asking my mom about them, and she said, well, look, they're a married couple, which always stuck in my mind as an 11-year-old, because even when I was 11, obviously, I knew I was gay. And I remember thinking, oh, she views them as a married couple, you know, at a time in America when most people didn't view gay people as married couples.
And in fact, Gloria, you saw your own mother actually in a lesbian relationship.
Yes, this was something that took me a long time to work out, because in the custody trial, this was in 1934 that we're talking about, when it came out that she was seen in bed with Lady Milford Haven, the court was closed, and it was an absolute terrible thing, and it filtered through to me, although of course I wasn't allowed to see any of the newspapers or anything, but it filtered through to me, and it absolutely terrified me, because I thought, maybe I'm going to be like that too, because I'll be like my mother and it's something terrible. And then I was told Oscar Wilde was put in prison for it and people were killed for it and so forth. So I had no idea what it meant until then. And it was something that took me a long time to work out. But then, of course, when I came to realize that love between a man and a man and a woman and a woman is exactly the same as love between a man and a woman. I mean, there is no difference at all. Love is love.
Love is love.
It should not be in any way thought of in any other way except that, because that is the truth of the matter. It really is.
Just for listeners who may not be familiar with the custody case that my mom was talking about, when she was 10 years old, she was taken away from her mother, and there was a custody battle between her mother and her aunt, who was fighting for custody of my mom.
Gloria, you quote writer Mary Gordon, who said, "A fatherless girl thinks all things possible and nothing safe." How did you interpret that?
Oh, that's absolutely true. When I read that, it was like a huge bell rang. It's absolutely true. I do think nothing is safe. And I think it comes from having my father died when I was 15 months old. And I was really raised by my nurse, who I called Dodo, and she was really like my mother. And my grandmother Morgan, who was a very forceful person, I called her Nanny Napoleon. She was that forceful.
She idolized Napoleon Bonaparte.
Idolized Napoleon. And so she was really like my father. And there were no men around at all except my mother's friends, who I would sort of see fleetingly going in and out of the house where we lived in Paris. And so those were my sort of parents, really, when I was growing up. There was no kind of father image at all. And I think because of that, a fatherless girl feels nothing is safe.
You know, you say nothing is safe, and yet you have got to be one of the biggest risk takers. I mean, risk taking in your ventures at professionalism, your risk taking with men. I mean, it does seem to me that beyond feeling not safe, you had the courage to make those risks.
I also think, Mom, that the other side of that quote, that all things are possible, is actually what you're talking about.
Exactly.
And I think it actually, all things are possible, meaning terrible things can happen, and that's what you learn when a parent dies, but also you realize anything can happen, extraordinary things can happen. I think my mom has focused on the potential extraordinary things that can happen. And I also think that quote applies to boys as well as girls. I think any child who loses a parent early on gets that feeling that all things are possible and nothing is safe.
Anderson, would you be good enough to read for us on page 243?
This is from The Rainbow Comes and Goes, and this is one of the conversations that my mom and I were having early on about much earlier in her life. My mom drank, and this is part of the conversation we had about that. "Do you think Mom is an alcoholic?" Carter once asked me when we were in high school. Carter was my brother. I was so shocked he said that word out loud that I didn't know how to respond. We'd never spoken of it before. Each of us dealt with it in silence. I was so surprised to hear him use the word that I dismissed his question and never spoke with him about it again. Put off by my silence, he never attempted to either. "Your drinking made it difficult to trust you. I never knew what I would find when I came home from school each day. I dreaded going anywhere with you, worried that you might start drinking. On planes, at restaurants, parties. The person you became scared and angered me. I was never sure if you were aware of what you were doing. I assumed you were, but I didn't know. The day after you drunk too much, it would be as if nothing had happened. It added another element of danger and fear to our lives and contributed to the feeling that we were somehow adrift. Even now, typing this out, I feel that fear. I can remember it and realize I've spent much of my adult life making sure I never feel that way again."
Gloria, when you read that, what did you feel?
Well, I brought it up in writing this Rainbow Comes and Goes book because it was something that was haunted me for most of my life, because my father was an alcoholic, and I always had the fear that I might too have inherited that. I also was afraid that I might be a lesbian, which to me was something in 1934, which was considered, well,
out of the ordinary
and strange, and put you in a kind of category as a kind of freak. And those two things really haunted me for a long time. And when I had periods of drinking, it would be drinking and sobbing. And the sobbing was like a kind of waterfall that would kind of wash it away momentarily. And the next morning, of course, to have a terrible hangover. Also, vanity, vanity, vanity. I would look in the mirror and I would think, no, I'm going to stop this because I don't want to ruin my looks and my body and my system and my health and so forth. And then, of course, eventually I did work it out, and I have not since Carter died, which is, 37 years ago?
Yeah.
I want to ask about that because I know that Carter's death, your brother, Anderson, how did that happen and what happened before and how it affected you both?
My brother Carter died in 1988, July 22nd, and he had come to my mother's house, had woken up from a nap, and went into my mom's room and asked, seemed disoriented, seemed out of it, and asked her, said, what's going on? What's going on? My mom said, nothing is going on. He ran out through upstairs. It was a duplex, through my room and out onto the balcony of our apartment.
You weren't there.
I wasn't. I was in Washington at the right. time. And my mom was there and she followed him and tried. He was sitting on the ledge of the balcony, 14 stories above the East River. And my mother was begging him to come in and he refused to. And a plane passed overhead and he looked up at the plane and then sort of flipped around so that he was hanging from the balcony by his hands and then let go. And he was 23 years old.
I think we ought to say he really did not seem, he seemed to be in almost like he was sleepwalking. He was not himself. It was like he was sort of shut into some kind of thing that was going on. And when I ran after him and went upstairs and he was sitting on the ledge and I got down on my knees and I said, Carter, and he sort of put his hand up and said, no, no, don't get up. So I got up quickly because I thought it might send him over. And then it was really like he did not know where he was. And then, of course, the plane came up and he looked up and it was kind of like a signal. And then he just went and hung over for a minute. And I said, Carter, come back. And I thought for a moment that he was going to jump back over, but he let go. It happened in seconds. I mean, seconds, like running up the stairs. The whole thing happened fast. He had been asleep, and it's my opinion now that I think he was possibly sleepwalking, which he never liked to sleep in the afternoon, and he'd fallen asleep.
Certainly something like that. I mean, it changes, you know, it changes everything, obviously.
Absolutely.
And
it changes. I mean, from that moment on, your whole life is completely, irrevocably changed in a blink.
And sometimes I interview people on television and, you know, people use the word closure. And I think it's such a terrible TV word.
The worst word in the dictionary.
I fully agree with you.
And whenever I hear a reporter ask somebody like, will this give you closure? I cringe because it's the word used by somebody who hasn't experienced
loss. How do you think it has affected your life going forward, Anderson?
You know, it reset the clock of my life.
How?
Just as my father's death reset the clock of my life. I think of time as before his death or after his death. And it certainly propelled me, you know, I became concerned about my own survival. It became questioning about why do some people survive and other people don't? Why do two brothers grow up in the same family? This happens to one and not to another. And I set about, frankly, you know, I was suffering and I wanted to be around other people who were surviving. And I started going to war zones. I started going to disaster areas with a fake press pass and a camera. And that's ultimately what led me to become a reporter.
And it affected your behavior differently, Gloria.
Yes. Well, after it happened, so many friends, of course, came to the apartment. And Anderson's reaction was to withdraw. You really didn't want to. You would come into the room and it was very hard to communicate with you because you just didn't seem to want to talk about it. Whereas I reacted completely differently. I wanted really to do nothing else but talk about it. And for three or four weeks after it happened, all I did was cry and wanted to talk about what had happened with everybody that came in. And that helped me so much to be able to do that. And then later I joined a group called Compassionate Friends, which is a wonderful organization, which you, I'm sure, know about.
Yes.
And that helped me so much to sort of go there and to be able to be with people who had experienced the same, either with a loved one, a child, or someone that they loved, had experienced something and was able to talk about it and to not be afraid to talk about it and to be free to talk about it. And that was really one of the things that helped me get back into standing on my feet again, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I learned, I mean, in the writing of this book and the conversation between my mom and I mean, we're very different in some ways in how we deal with things. I mean, my mom is much more communicative. She talks. In something like this, I get very quiet and I sort of have a conversation in my head, but I do find it hard to kind of talk about things.
You withdraw, yes.
You know, that brings us to the title of the book, The Rainbow Comes and Goes. Explain why you wanted that title.
It's Wordsworth. It's from a Wordsworth poem.
Yes.
And my mom had said it to me a couple times in an email, and it stuck in my head, and I found myself using the phrase all the time. Like, someone would say, hey, how's it going? And I never know how to answer that question.
Yeah.
Like, oh, everything's great. And
yeah, yeah.
So I found myself saying, the rainbow comes and goes. And I like it because my mom and I both interpret it differently, which shows the difference between us. My mom, who's the most optimistic person and believes the next great love is just around the corner, even now at 92, you know, she sees the rainbow comes and goes as, well, great things are always going to happen. I view it as, you know what? How do you know you're going to be there when the rainbow does come back?
Gloria, how has your perspective on death changed as you've gotten older?
Well, it actually changes quite a lot. Some days I do think that everyone has the right to take their own life if they decide that the time has come to do it. And I think that it should be made available to people that want to do it. And this is something that should be legal. It should not be something that there's a stigma against the person. So I do believe in it, and I probably will at some point.
How would you feel, Anderson? How do you feel hearing your mother speak that way? How would you feel if she decided to end her own life?
I've been hearing my mom speak this way for my entire life, so nothing my mom says surprises me. There's nothing she could possibly say that I haven't heard before. But, you know, I understand where she's coming from, and I do think people should have death with dignity.
Now a quick break. More from my 2016 conversation with Gloria Vanderbilt and Anderson Cooper when we come back. Vanderbilt died last month at age 95.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Gloria Vanderbilt and Anderson Cooper. Tell me about why you, Anderson Cooper, did not want your name associated with the Vanderbilt name.
I was just very happy that my last name was Cooper. You know, I grew up, my dad was from a poor family in Mississippi. I had grew up with a lot of connection to that side of the family. My mom, who didn't really feel ever, she always felt like an imposter in the Vanderbilt family. I think having that last name Vanderbilt comes with all sorts of baggage. People assume the reason I didn't want people even to know who my mom, that I was the son of my mom for a long time when I started out in my career, is that people make these assumptions about, oh, you must have, you know, a pot of gold somewhere, you must have a trust fund, none of which is true. I mean, my mom and my dad both sat me down when I was a kid and said, your college will be paid for and stuff, but after that, you're on your own.
You have
to make
your
way. And I was appreciative of that. I never wanted there to be a trust fund. I look at families who have trust funds and stuff, and a lot of times I think it sucks your initiative.
Why do you think that was important, Gloria, for him to be on his own so young?
Well, I lived with my mother in Paris after my father died until I was 9, and she never mentioned the Vanderbilts at all. I mean, I didn't even know that they existed until I was brought to America and I met Aunt Gertrude Whitney. And
really, until the
Vanderbilt
custody case.
I knew that my name was Gloria Vanderbilt, but I didn't connect it with any well-known family. So it was a complete revelation to me when I discovered that the Vanderbilts were this incredibly, you know, rich family that lived in America and were part of American history, and that I was related to them, but I always felt that I was an imposter, I was really not related to them, that it was sort of that I kind of got there under false pretenses, and that's probably because I didn't know they existed until I was, you know, 9 years old
and
when
I think
came to America.
It's always been important for my mom, and certainly with my dad for when he was alive, to accomplish things on their own and to achieve things. My mom has always been driven not by a desire for money, but by a desire to make a mark and create beauty and create art. And so I think she wanted that for me as well. She wanted me to feel like my own person and not have these expectations that, you know, I think that inherited money, I think it changes who you are. It messes with your head. And, you know, I've been very lucky. Money is not a driving force in my life, but I've been obviously very comfortable and I'm very happy that I've been able to do the work that I continue to do.
Well, the only money that has ever meant anything real to me is the money that I've made on my own, not money that I inherited.
But
that's the money
that's
real.
Gloria, I gather when you turned 21, you were taken to the lawyer's office and told you had inherited $4.5 million, which you then shared with your mother, taking care of her, taking care of others as well.
Yes, I took care of my nurse for many, many years.
The amazing thing is no one had ever prepared my mom. Never one had ever told my mom that she was going to be getting this money.
Exactly.
No one had ever even, you know, suggested like a life plan for her. And so she suddenly at age 21, it was literally brought into a bank vault and, you know, told you have all this money.
But then what happened?
Well,
then, of course, I met Leopold Stokowski.
Exactly.
And
who was a famous, world famous conductor who,
right,
I should point out, was 63 years old. And my mom was 21.
And of course, age had nothing to do with it, except the fact that I do think that he, I mean, looking at it from the point of view of now and looking back, he did, of course, represent the father that I never had. And I thought he was a genius. And I thought he was kind of a god, you know.
I still don't get it.
Yeah, you don't get it. But he became very controlling, Gloria.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I turned my life over to him. I was like a geisha wife, you know. And I traveled with him all over the world when he was conducting, and I was in his dressing room, you know, taking care of his, helping him dress and so forth. And then, of course, when our children were born, then I didn't travel with him anymore, but I was totally dedicated to him. And I did start painting then.
Did any of your friends ever say, like, wait a minute, you're 21, you're beautiful, you have money on your own, and you're going to
marry
this 63-year-old guy? Did any friend ever say, like, what's up with that?
No, I mean,
nobody did.
You probably never asked their advice
either. But you see, he was not like a 63-year-old
man.
I mean, I know it's hard to.
He kind of looked like a 63-year-old.
But now, Gloria, here's what I want to ask, because this connection between you and Wyatt Cooper happened almost instantaneously. Tell me what happened.
Well, I was married to Sidney Lumet, and we were married for 7 years, and it was during the time when I was an actress, and I worked a lot with Sidney directing, and that was my total focus in life, although I was still painting at the time. And Sidney and I went to Louise McGrath's for dinner, and there was Wyatt Cooper. And afterwards, Louise said that, you know, that he was quite taken with me. And as I said to Anderson, you know, I was quite taken with him. Otherwise, he wouldn't be here.
And you have inherited your dad's blue eyes, which was so taken.
Yeah,
with.
His were even bluer, but
really,
they were really piercing. But yeah, we looked.
Diane Anderson is the spitting image of his dad.
That's what
really,
I understand.
Really is.
Yeah,
yes.
Go ahead.
It was interesting, actually. There's an organization I think called Clock Tower Radio. They restore old radio programs, and I got a tweet or a letter from them about a year ago that they had restored a radio interview my dad had done on public radio in 1976. And it was a radio interview about my brother and I and about families. And they put it online, and I heard my dad's voice for the first time since I was 10 years old.
Wow. Gloria, tell me what writing this book with Anderson has meant to you.
Well, it's really been a kind of extraordinary communication, something that we sort of just flowed back and forth between us
what
without any editing.
What do you think you've learned about Anderson or from Anderson that you didn't know before?
Oh, my goodness. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways.
My mom is not a tough critic of mine. She's always very, very supportive.
Pretty supportive.
Well, I discovered that he has great warmth, which I think very often, well, because of, you know, the profession you're in, you have to be objective, and so you are. We never discuss, you know, anything that he's doing on air or anything. Although, of course, I'm always dying to to question him, but I never do.
To get the backstory, to get the real
the real deal.
I remain absolutely zipper mouth, you know. And
I mean, I think for me, one of the things that, the thing that really came, I mean, for me, this book was really, this conversation we had was life-changing. It's why I really urge people to try to change the conversation they have, particularly with an aging parent or a parent with their adult child, because I think it really, it's made this past year really the most important year of my life. And I've realized, I've always thought I was so much like my dad because we look so much alike, but I realized through this new conversation that I really am my mother's son and how much she and I are alike, and in good ways and bad, but just how much we actually do share.
Anderson Cooper, Gloria Vanderbilt, thank you. That's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Look for past podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Yuriv-Livker. And a quick note before we sign off for today, the podcast is taking a break for the rest of the month. I'll be traveling out of the country, so look for pictures of my adventures on our social media feeds. And I'm looking forward to bringing you new podcasts in August. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.